Blog Talk Radio.
Baseball fans everywhere. My name is Michael LeColin, also known as the Brooklyn Trolley Blogger, and I welcome you to another episode of the Metsian Podcast. Lots to do, lots to discuss. I will waste no time and bring on my partners, and we'll get down to the nitty-gritty. First, hailing from somewhere doing something, Sam Maxwell, everyone. How you doing, brother?
What is going on? As always, I am live on location from somewhere. I mean, the bus had to drive up right next to me, of course, right now, as you're introducing me. But I am live from the Brooklyn Bridge, ladies and gentlemen, as I will be able to prove in moments on social media. But, yeah, it's nice to have a W tucked in at this hour, Mike.
Without a doubt. And hailing from Connecticut, major Beatles fan, my fellow football Giants fan, and somebody who's also taken in the hockey playoffs as a Ranger fan. Rich Spirago, everyone.
How you doing, Mike? How's everybody doing tonight? You know, if you're a Mets fan and you're not feeling good and doing well baseball-wise, I don't know. Something's wrong because you have to be feeling good. I'm feeling great about the Mets right now. Yes, I know it's early, but I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. And a lot of it is because of our New York Mets, I'll be honest with you. They affect my mood, and my mood is good right now.
Indeed, indeed. I couldn't agree with you more. Lots of good, positive things going on. But you know me, when I'm in control, I like to play the role of contrarian. And it's up to you guys to change my method of thinking. But first, you know, let's talk about family matters, and what do I mean by that? Local matters, the Brooklyn Cyclones, weather in Staten Island. When fog rolls through this area, I'm about five blocks off the water. And, you know, this part of Brooklyn in the city, this is the confluence of the East River, the Hudson River, New York Harbor, and the Atlantic Ocean. And when the fog rolls in, it gets pulled like a curtain. And either Staten Island disappears from view from Brooklyn, or Brooklyn and Manhattan get, you know, disappeared from view from Staten Island view. So tonight, the Ferry Hawks are in action. They got their game underway, no problem. As we know, the manager over there is Edgardo Alfonso. And the pitching coach is Nelson Figueroa, who got ejected this evening in the fifth inning. I just figure I'd throw that out there. But the Cyclones here in Coney Island, they got fogged out. Couldn't see 3 feet in front of your face. Funny weather over here on the Narrows, so I just wanted to throw that out there. Sam, I'm going to throw you a bone, but don't thank me. We have Noah Syndergaard to thank for this one. You weren't with us the last podcast when we celebrated the five-man combined no-hitter. I'd like you to chime in.
Right.
But Noah Syndergaard had something to say about that. And there's also a rebuttal to his comments. So let's break open the minutia. Let's get into a little bit of no-hitter and social media. Sam, what did you think about that combined no-hitter?
Well, first of all, I got to pick up on the weather that you're talking about. I mean, I'm now after the Brooklyn Bridge in downtown Brooklyn, and there's not a fog in sight right now. There's no sheets at all. So it is pretty remarkable what you're talking about regarding both the Mets minor leagues as well as a connection to the Mets minor leagues with some of those names you mentioned, Mike. In terms of the combined no-hitter, speaking of the Mets, and especially with what you talked about, Rich, see, I always enjoyed the fact that the first official no-hitter on the books of the Mets also was an unofficial one-hitter because there had been so many official one-hitters in Mets history, 35, in fact, before Johan threw his no-hitter. And there's plenty to have talked about in terms of the human element and those games going to one hit. Specifically, I always hear about the lore of the Dwight Gooden game in 1986 that an error could have easily been called. Ironically, it was another third baseman for the Mets, Ray Knight, after just something that came up in my day today. R.A. Dickey and David Wright booted something that probably could have been called an error in the first inning in an R.A. Dickey one-hitter. But alas, I digress, although that was 2012. I do think that there's something really nice about, one, how clean this no-hitter was, and two, the fact that it had to be a collective effort on the New York Mets' part. I really appreciate that about this second no-hitter in New York Mets history. And what you also talked about, Rich, is that it's a rare thing. Nobody is really giving any credit to the idea that a combined no-hitter is a harder thing to do than one ace, just absolutely having it, running on adrenaline by the time you get to the seventh, eighth, and ninth. Everybody, you know, and mind you, like the ironic part is that a lot of those pitchers talked about not even realizing it was a no-hitter, but they knew that the game was at stake and that they had to shut it down somehow, some way. And even like Jolly Rodriguez, who we didn't depend on, now has a bit more dependency on him. And then a lot of us were sour on Edwin Diaz. And I think we watched the maturation of Edwin Diaz right before our eyes that night, and saw him own, absolutely own the moment, and really seemed like he was enjoying it. What Max Scherzer talked about was that the pressure is a privilege. Edwin Diaz seemed to pick up on that ninth inning, and that's what I thought about the no-hitter. I absolutely loved it, and I loved being a part, at least at home, of every minute of it.
So we have the matter of Noah Syndergaard interjecting his opinion. Didn't go over so well if you asked Max Scherzer. How about that, Rich?
Well, yeah, there is some question about whether or not that was valid by Scherzer or not. I don't know if you guys know definitively. I saw it and I cracked up. I thought it was wonderful.
No, I think if you look closer, I'm sorry to interject, but if you look closer at the actual meme or whatever, it says under the words, what Max Scherzer may have said or something like that. It was, if you look at the fine print, it's clearly a joke.
Right, and it's a funny one, and I loved it anyway. Would have been great if he did say it, but, you know, Mike, I said this on the last podcast. I'm going to say it again. That was wonderful. I agree with what Sam said. If you have a combined no-hitter, two things to keep in mind. Number one, it's still a no-hitter. The other team didn't get any hits, so by definition, it's still a no-hitter. And number two, three things. It's statistically more rare, only 17 in Major League Baseball history of the 300-plus no-hitters, like 325 or so that have been thrown, I think it's actually over 330. Only 17 have been combined no-hitters, so it's something that is a real statistical rarity in baseball. And Sam hit the nail on the head. If it's 2, 3, 4, in the Mets case, 5, pitchers, everybody has to be on point. You had 5 hands touching that baseball, and not one of them made the mistake that allowed the Phillies to get a hit. So it's more statistically rare for a reason. It's harder to do. How many times do we see it? We saw it with Kershaw early in the season. You know, 7 no-hit innings. He goes out. Bullpen lets up a hit. You know, that's why this thing is so rare, because it's very difficult to do. And for Syndergaard, getting back to him, you know, as far as I'm concerned, every tweet by Syndergaard, and I'll throw Stroman in there too, it just reeks of they're very unhappy that they're not here enjoying the resurgence of the New York Mets. How else can you read it? Why does it matter to him? Why did he have to go on social media and say this is what a real no-hitter looks like? Dude, you're embarrassing yourself. You're making it very clear you're bitter that the Mets did offer the qualifying offer, but you're bitter that another team offered you more. you're not here and you see that the Mets, after all the years that you were here, the Mets could actually be on to something special, and he's bitter about it. It's obvious. It's psychology 101. And because there's no need to have to even say anything, congratulate your own guy on social media. And then if you notice later in the day, he walked it back. He said, I wasn't talking about the Mets. I was talking about whatever it was. Come on. We know damn well what he was trying to do. And and I, to a degree, I feel sorry for the guy. I mean, if he's that bitter, you know, and he's – can you imagine he was here, you know, during some of the lean years, like 17 and 18, and he was here during those years, and he was a Met right through, and he Tommy John surgery, all of that. If this is the year, the Mets might Bryce Harper him. You know, if this is the year the Mets win the World Series when he wasn't here, I could understand. I can understand feeling a bit weird about it, but he looks childish taking it to social media, in my opinion.
I thought it was kind of funny. Sam, any last comments about that?
No, just in terms of Noah Syndergaard, I think that he likes to play into this. I think it's like he's played into his, you know, the social media elements of his personality.
Yeah.
And he is trying to kind of do that up a little bit much. And, it's just, especially considering that they're having a great season too. And it just, it kind of makes you realize, and you know, 2015, Noah Syndergaard just came up, I guess, in May or June. And in 2016, he was brilliant and had a great wild card game. But other than that, he hasn't had much playoff success. And it also just makes me think about the fact that, like, what David Wright and Bobby Parnell tried to do early on in his career didn't necessarily seem to work, considering that he's still exactly kind of the same childish goofball that could work on a team. It just seems like this came off as too tied to the Noah Syndergaard element of his of what's going on for him, as opposed to the Halo part of what's going on for him. So that was really my take. It was a glaring, all right, you know, we have the right collection. Whatever happens at the end of this year, there is just a bit more seriousness in the air, whether that be Buck, Max, or otherwise. Just everything coming together, there's a reason Noah Syndergaard's not on this team.
I just thought it was funny. I thought it was Noah being Noah. Anyway, Rich, I believe it was the day after last week's podcast, the Mets staged that incredible ninth inning comeback.
I remember being surly during that game, you know, which is not uncommon for me when they're losing. And just, you know, they looked lifeless. They were down 7-1. They had lost the previous day to the Braves. Nothing puts me in a worse mood than a Mets loss to the Braves. And so now they're getting blown out in Philadelphia. And it's like, oh, my God. You know, and it was just annoying. Everything was irritating me. Come on. If anybody thought they had a chance to win that game, you're more of an optimist than I. Anyway, so then it starts off. You get the 2-run home run by Lindor, and it looks cosmetic. You know, they're Mary Kay runs. They're cosmetic runs. And so, okay. Then as they start to put the inning together, you know, you get the hit by Pete. All right, you know, a couple more hits, give yourself a chance, right? And then Escobar makes the out, and you're like, oh, well, okay, forget that. Now there's one out, man on second. McNeil gets the hit. Canna gets the hit. Now you've got a chance. Now you've got tying runs are on base. And then, you know, when Dom struck out, it's like, well, now it's really over, you know, two outs. And then JD, you think about what happened there. JD hit that ball so hard, two things. If he gets under it, it's out. It's out of the ballpark, game tied, right? But if he hits that ball 3 inches lower, it's caught by Bohm, game over that way. So it just shows you, cliche, I know, but baseball is such a game of inches. And then now when J.D. gets that double and the tying runs are in scoring position, I'm standing up. It's like, oh, my God, there's life again. But you still think, at least I thought, because so much can go wrong, you still think, probably not, but hell of a fight here. And then when Nimmo gets that hit, it was like – it kind of felt like the ball going through Buckner's leg. I take that back. It kind of felt like the wild pitch in that game six where the game's tied. And in that moment, you just have a feeling there's no way they're losing this game. Too much has happened. It's cosmic. And then when Marte came up, it was sort of like I don't know about you guys, but to me it was like I just knew he was going to do something. You just knew it. And damn near hit the ball out of the ballpark. And then so they go ahead, and then Diaz comes in, and he's lights out. I've been following this team since the early 70s. God, I can't think of a more thrilling regular season win. I really can't. If there is one, the Carl Everett game, but the Mets were pretty much out of it by then. It was a September game. They were kind of fighting for their lives in 97. They had a slim chance, but it was late season. But with the way things are going for this team, to layer that win on top of it, that it was after that game, I truly felt that something special is happening. So that's my take on it.
Sam, just another instance of games gone good. How did that game make you feel?
It's one of those moments when you realize why you keep listening to Howie Rose and Wayne Randazzo till the ninth inning is over. It's just, you know that that's the type of fan you are. You say it's most likely not going to happen, but you kind of remind yourself of times that you were around, special moments like that. And for me, I drew back to when I was in the stands when the Mets were facing the Nationals. And I think it was earlier on, it was the sixth inning or so, and they were down 7-1. When they were trying to, like, really put a rubber stamp on their division win down in D.C. back in 2015. And I remember, like, I wouldn't sit down because from the beginning of the inning, I was, like, half standing, sitting on the top of the seats, the foldable seats. And so I wouldn't sit down that entire inning. And very similarly, the strike zone was lost in that game. Here, the Mets just kept tacking it on after the big bomb by Lindor at the beginning of the inning. It's got to be also talked about in terms of Marte getting that started with beating out that infield single where the Phillies look like they're just a team that has a lot of mental issues going on right now, basically, more or less. And I think throughout that inning, it wasn't just the Mets coming back, but it was the Phillies just losing themselves as well. And everything that I know about what's going on down there and kind of how they're really frustrated with how things have gone with Girardi, you kind of saw that start to unfold within the entire thing. Everybody just felt substantially more blasé than the Mets, who were just, it didn't matter how far behind they were determined to show that they were the better team for the night. And there was, like, it's been talked about that the Mets are the team that always leaves the tying run or the winning run on base or on deck. Since 1962, when they lost 50 of the 120 losses, they left the tying run on base or on deck. They had that kind of chance in 1962 in 50 of the games they lost. So this was a very – to basically fake us out. Mets fans are used to this since 1962. And there was a part of me that was just like knew that not only had it had changed to the point that I had more faith in this team than ever before – but it may have been one of those just franchise redefining games that seem to continue to have during the season. And mind you, that might be very overdramatic, but everything that I just laid forth regarding the way we leave the time run on base or on deck when we lose, there was something definitively different, even if the Mets had done this before. And that's one of the things I loved about that game, and the fact that it was just like, I'd been listening to the entire game, and, you know, they talked about on sports radio the next day, like, how many of you actually were listening to that? You know, Craig Carton, who's the cynic, you know, that was the first question out of the gate for his and Evan Roberts' show. But that's what I felt was, you know, I did. I was listening, you know, and I think the three of us, even if there was a Ranger game going on, it seems like that was a big thing, was just like the Ranger game was over. They had won at the time. And people were like, yeah, let's see what's going on with the Mets game. I don't need to listen to Lundqvist. And either they caught it or they had to go back on their DVR to see what happened.
A lot of fun playing division foes. Just to recap the month, we opened up the month of May. We split four games with the Atlanta Braves. We took two out of three from the Phillies, and we just now completed two out of three against Washington. And it's been said before, but bears repeating, and I'm just going to say what I wrote earlier today. The first-place Mets lead the National League in wins and still have yet to lose a series this season. They're getting it done with solid pitching, fielding, and timely hitting. Today was a perfect example. Solid pitching to Juan Walker, seven beautiful innings, fielding. They got two very important outs in the fourth inning today, turned into a double play that shouldn't have been the double play, and timely hitting. And, you know, Mr. Khanna, he wielded a very hot bat today. So the old adage, solid pitching, fielding, and timely hitting, was front and center today at Washington. What say you, Rich?
Well, I think you hit it, Mike. I think a game like today, two observations. Number one, it was a very businesslike win. You know, the Mets are better than the Nationals. I don't think anybody would question that. A lot of teams are better than the Nationals. But the Mets are definitely better than the Nationals. So they went out there after having lost last night and did what good teams do. They beat bad teams in the series. That is what they do. There was nothing particularly spectacular about today's game other than one thing that I'll talk about in a moment. So you have a guy who, in Canna, who frankly has been in a slump. He's been solid. You know, he's been getting a lot of singles, but, you know, certainly not anything to write home about. He hasn't been great shakes. And this is the guy today. Two runs in the first inning with a single. Great. Home run to ice the games, make it 4-0. Great. So you have someone else step up who, you know, unlikely hero in a game that you just had to find a way to win because you're better than those guys. And they did it. It was efficient. They got it done. Taijuan Walker was very, very good after a not-so-good start, so that's what you want to see there. And then that double play is something that, you know, that's the kind of mistake, as Keith would say, bad teams make. But capitalizing on that mistake and getting the fundies right, also as Keith would say, is what good teams do. You know, Taijuan Walker was there covering third base. Great. But he throws the ball in the right field. Well, how about that backup by Starling Marte? That's what good teams do. They throw the runner out at third. You get two outs on a very bizarre play. So while the game was efficient, it looked like a good team playing a bad team, which is what's supposed to happen. You get that little twist of, aha, this is why the Mets are different this year, because they do these little things like that. That double play to me is just indicative of how, because people were in the right place at the right time, they were able to pull that off. And to me, that speaks volumes. I think you're muted, Mike.
My apologies, gentlemen. Sam, take it away. How did today's game make you feel?
Well, for one, I got to start with my man, Taijuan Walker, who was part of that play that we were talking about. They kept thinking he downplayed how much pain he was in at the end of the game, but they thought he was in some discomfort one way or another. And he really battled through that game. I wouldn't say miraculously, but brilliantly, just absolutely using whatever. And I guess this is where the art of pitching comes in, is that you have to feel out whatever the Cosmics are giving you today. And that's certainly what Taijuan Walker did. And he got 7 scoreless innings out of it. And not like 7 sloppy scoreless innings. They were very efficient. He could have gone maybe like another inning or in traditional sense, all 9. Like, he really probably could have. And that's really where I think that, you know, combined with how good Taijuan Walker is, especially after his last start where he wasn't so good, as well as how this team keeps giving you confidence that in games such as today, just because of their track record so far, they're going to know what it takes to bounce back. Like Rich was saying, they're clearly a better team, and we've known the Mets are the better team before, but it hasn't been clear by the results at the end of the game, at the end of these types of games. And, you know, this is my theme of the night, is that there's a sense that something is different.
I'm glad you guys are taking me down this alley. It's exactly where I wanted to go. I also wrote earlier today, we've seen this before, gentlemen. The season is about a fifth of the way through. Let us pause and ask what differentiates this team from last year's Mets, who on August 14th dropped out of first place, fell behind the Phillies and the Braves, and never recovered. So, keeping that in mind, let's address everybody and everything with that in mind and, you know, distinguish what went wrong last year and what potentially or what we hope will go right this year. And I'm going to start with Brandon Nimmo. Today he was 1-for-2, 2 walks and a run scored. .413 on base percentage. He's batting .290. And I'm going to bring Michael Conforto into this conversation. Now, I'm only going to use last year as an example. Michael Conforto did not prove his worth in the 2021 season. And therefore, that's probably why he didn't resign with the Mets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Brandon Nimmo is now in that same situation. Is he proving his worth? ? Is he doing the things that separate him amongst his contemporaries insofar as being a leadoff hitter? Is he carving out that niche for himself where he's becoming one of the game's best? And is that worth the investment into Brandon Nimmo? Because after the season, he becomes a free agent. So he's in the same position that Michael Conforto was last year. And, you know, I got my fingers crossed. His problem has always been an ability or inability to stay on the field. Hell, so far so good. What say you, Rich?
Well, you know, I think it's a knee-jerk reaction to a degree to say a guy's playing well, let's extend him, let's give him a contract. You know, that could be a bad strategy. However, with Nimmo, I don't think it is. Here's a guy who, yes, the biggest flaw with Nimmo is his inability is a bad word. He's missed more time than you would like to see because of injury. Sometimes guys get injured and it just might be the way they play. Sometimes things are freak. So I'm going to throw that out, actually. And I'm going to say what you have in Brandon Nimmo is kind of the quintessential top-of-the-order guy. His OBP coming into today was .402. That's what you want. You want somebody getting on base, batting first or second, and he's getting on base 40% of the time. That's elite. And so I don't really care about his .286 batting average, which is pretty good, but his .402 on base percentage for where he is in the lineup, that's what you want and that's what you're getting. You got a guy who hustles, who's a good teammate, a good clubhouse guy. Yes, I know he smiles all the time. That's not a bad thing. You know, he's not a sullen kind of a guy. He's an upbeat guy. The players really seem to like him. And let's not forget, he has become a very good center fielder. You know, he was below league average going into this year. I think he's going into last year. He improved last year. It's about league average. I think he's a bit above this year. But he is progressing as a center fielder to a point where he's above league average. So what's not to like about this guy? You have him at the top of your lineup. He does the exact job at an elite level that you want the people at your top of your lineup to do. He's a good clubhouse figure. He hustles all the time. He's a good defender. He has occasional power. I don't see why the Mets should not be talking to this guy and locking him up. I really don't see it. And yeah, I'm trying to avoid the knee-jerk reaction. Okay, but I don't think that this is a knee-jerk reaction. I think this is genuinely earned by Nimmo and would be a wise baseball move.
How you feel, Sam?
I can't disagree with anything Rich just said. And before, like, knocking it down, I would say one of the things that I love about Brandon Nimmo is that he has done a great job understanding who he is as a major leaguer and not whatever hype there was from the beginning about how, you know, they did low risk, high reward type thing, signing him out of high school when there wasn't even any high school baseball in Wyoming. And he hasn't become like that type of like Mike Trout elite talent, but he knows what he's good at. He does continue to get better at it as a hitter, but just like Rich said, he realized he has a tenacity for getting on base and he became elite at it. He realized what his major strength was as a major leaguer and he leaned into it. And that is definitely something, especially considering the continuity you want, especially in this day and age, out of a team. I would only be the contrarian by saying, like, I haven't taken a look at who the other free agents are next year going into the offseason. So I would want to do that before I completely agree on an extension midseason.
Very good. You're listening to the Metsian Podcast. I'm Michael LeColin with my partners Sam Maxwell and Rich Spirago. Gentlemen, Pete Alonso, his adaptability, his adjustments, his whole major league career has been an adjustment. Excuse me. He's second in the league in RBIs. Whatever you want to say, Rich.
Well, you know, I think the thing with Pete is you know what you're going to get from him, right? You know you're going to get power. I mean, he clearly can hit the living crap out of the ball. We saw it in Philly on Sunday with two home runs in game two. We saw it last night, albeit in a losing effort. So you know you're going to get home runs. If he stays healthy, you're probably going to get every year 35 to 45, somewhere in there. And you count on that. But the thing about Pete that is even better is he's, like Keith always says, he's becoming a really good hitter. He's going to right field a lot. Like they showed it last night. I remember the actual number, but I think it's 40% of his hits have gone to right field this year. So he's actually becoming something other than a slugger. Going into today's game, he's hitting .287. If you give me any player, but let's just say he normalizes that a bit, so his .287 becomes .275. He hits .275 on the season, and we'll split the home runs in the middle at 40. And though he's projected for about 120 RBIs at this pace, let's just say he ends up with 100. So if you get a player who's hitting you 275, 35, 100, that is a damn good major league hitter. So I think with Pete, he's giving you more than you bargained for, to use a cliche, because you bargained for the power. But he's giving you solid offense. He's going the other way. He's doing the things that smart players do. So, again, I don't see how you could not be happy with this guy. And he plays a decent first base. I know he wants to be out there all the time, and yes, I know his DH numbers are better and blah, 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 blah. But when I look at Pete, I look at a guy who the home runs were the given. The other stuff he's doing is at a pretty good level, making him a complete player, and I'm damn happy the Mets have him.
How you feel about it, Tim?
Well, I think Pete can be the leader of a grand army, Mike, and I only say that because for a little Brooklyn deep cut, I'm right outside Grand Army Plaza entering Prospect Park now, so things might get a little quieter, right, ladies and gentlemen. But Pete Alonso, I think, doesn't get enough credit, crazy enough. I mean, it's just like, what can I really add to what Rich just laid out, numbers-wise? If you're talking about somebody who hits 275 to 285 a year and can give you the power he does with 100 to 120 RBIs, most likely, Pete is, yeah, like Rich said, his entire career has been an adjustment, and that is what separates the Jeff Francoeurs from the Pete Alonzos. And how, you know, you kind of got that feeling after his first season. And even after, you know, the kind of stunted 2020, that Pete Alonso was going to be, you know, an elite first base major league hitter for the foreseeable future. And he continues to prove that.
I got two more quick topics here on the offensive side. Sam, you mentioned the name Jeff McNeil. I'll be honest with you. Last year, I was in a rush to package him and trade him, and he's having a stellar season to date. Bring that up, and I hope my eyes deceive me when I think I saw that Mark Canha was taking reps at first base. Big giant question mark, and my point there is Dom Smith. You know, what's going on with him? He only has 58 at bats. So if you want to tackle one at a time, Sam, I'll stay with you.
Dom Smith is a strange one to tackle. And, of course, I'm getting a little bit more noise in Prospect Park than I would like to at this hour. But let's just go ahead and start with Dom Smith. I mean, he went 4-for-4 last Sunday on the national stage, the ESPN game against the Phillies. And I think it was last Sunday. I guess it might even be more than two Sundays ago. But he just hasn't been able to get enough hits in the time that he is there, other than that game, to be able to give Buck a reason why he needs to put him in the lineup on more than a daily basis. I think a lot of us believe that Dom, with consistent reps, can be a great, consistent major league hitter. But he's not able to get that with the Mets. And it's just maybe one of the reasons why they're trying Marcana, because they're just preparing for the eventuality that they use Dom as the perfect trade chip. Because as valuable as I've said that Dom can still be to this team, and as valuable as can still be to this team, you have to say one way or another that I don't think the team would fall apart without Dom Smith on this team, especially in improving the team. What was the first thing you went with again? Jeff McNeil. I'm so thrilled as I watch him be a complete hitter again that Jeff McNeil did not get included in anything. And I hope he doesn't get included, because I think that it's clear Jeff McNeil can be an insanely good overall hitter at this level. And I hope that he continues. I think that it should be mentioned that Eric Chavez seems to have brought a very good balanced approach to the way he's doing the job with all of these hitters, one way or another. And Jeff McNeil seems to be included in that.
Mike, Mike, muted.
Hey, Mikey.
I'm sorry. Rich, the floor is open to you. Same thing, Dom Smith, Jeff McNeil, Mark Hahn at first base, if that's true. However, I want to sprinkle this in as well. Raccoon, Gate from last year, Lindor and Jeff McNeil this year. And I only bring this up because that rat in the grass, that was kind of cute. But that to me, and I'm asking you, if you think that if Buck Showalter was manager last year, Raccoon, would that have happened?
Good question. My guess is it may have, but it would have been handled differently. Because if you think about it, I you know, who knows if those guys had anything going on beforehand. But if you remember that play in the inning before that happened in the dugout, it was something we've seen. Actually, we saw it, a week ago or so, between Lindor and McNeil, where they both kind of looked at the ball and neither one really went for it. And they didn't communicate and went by, and they both looked bad in a situation like that. And I think it's a situation where, you know, they were both unhappy. They were both a bit embarrassed, and, you know, they came to a shoving match in the clubhouse. So I'm not going to say that Buck would be the elixir to make that not happen, because it's something that happened on the field and got two professional athletes angry. But the way it was handled afterward, you know, the press conference with Rojas and you know, with Lindor and that incredibly awkward thing that he came on and goes, oh, I said it was a damn rat. No, he says a raccoon. I think Buck would have handled that much more adeptly before any of those guys got in front of a television camera. And they would have had something to say, which probably would have been nothing. They would have said, oh, we're keeping that in-house. Next question. Oh, okay. I was like, nope, we're keeping that in-house. Next question. Whatever it was, Buck would have handled that in front of the media much differently. You saw, you know, everybody was – then Pete with the Donnie Stevenson thing and whatever it was. I just think that would have been handled more professionally were Buck in role. So that's my first comment. About Dom, at some point – look, we love Dom. Everybody loves Dom. I do. At what point do you just call it what it is and say he doesn't fit here? He doesn't. If you are committing to Pete full-time, Dom doesn't fit here. He's too young to be a DH. He doesn't want to be a DH. And if that's the case, you know, he's not going to get the playing time. This is going to continue to happen. You're wasting a talent. It's better for Dom to go somewhere else. It's better for the Mets if they could package him with something else and get a piece they might need back. It's just not a fit, and it's unfortunate. And, if, you know, if the Mets ever said, we're going to go with Dom and they're going to trade Pete because Pete's at the top of his game and get more value, okay, you know, go with one or the other. Clearly going to be Pete for what he does. You've got to trade Dom. He's not a DH. And so there are only two options here. First base or DH, and he's not a DH. He doesn't want to be. He's not good at it. Doesn't like it. So at some point, the Mets have to come to that realization. Is it at the end of this season? Is it during the season? I don't know, but I think they will come to that realization. And so, all right, so that's Dom. And then McNeil, you know, I was pining for Javi Baez to come back. I was with you, Mike. I wanted to package McNeil. I thought his antics had just gotten old. I thought he was a bad clubhouse presence, that he and Lindor would never, you know, yin and yang. But McNeil has happily proven me wrong. He's the McNeil we saw in 2018, the first half of 2019. I love when he slaps the ball the other way. By the way, quick reference on the Philly comeback. When McNeil came up, when Pete was on second with no outs, the Mets were still down four runs. If you notice, he tried to push a bunt down the third baseline. It went foul, and he ended up getting a hit. But that's the Jeff McNeil that we love. It's a heady play. He knew they needed base runners. Gaping hole on the left side. He was going to do the right thing. That shows you how much Jeff McNeil has become the old Jeff McNeil. So I'm happy I was wrong about that. I'd still have to find a spot for Baez somewhere, but anyway, I guess it's not going to happen. I'm happy I was that they didn't listen to my advice and they didn't trade McNeil, because now he has become one of the most valuable pieces on this team.
Agreed. That's all I got on the offensive side of things. Just to recap, we're about a fifth of the way in. The Mets are number one in team average, number one in on-base percentage, and number six in runs. That sounds like competitive baseball. On the mound, and Rich, I'm going to stay with you. You left off last week asking me what I looked forward to in the week to come. And one of my first answers was I had my eye on Carlos Carrasco, that I was looking for him to be consistent and effective. And, you know, I was crossing my fingers hoping that that would come to fruition. And so far, so good. My confidence is building. How does he make you feel?
Well, again, I was incredibly wrong about Carlos Carrasco. If you look at it, you know, he's 35 years old, coming off of an injury. He hadn't, he didn't pitch the first two thirds of 2021. And when he did pitch, he was literally dreadful. You know, his ERA was over six. Coming back from injury, come on. I mean, I know, I was wrong, but I think I went with the evidence I saw, which is an aging pitcher who probably can't withstand these injuries anymore, and he probably had his best days in Cleveland. Well, you know what? He's been money. Other than that one start against the Cardinals, where he wasn't awful, he just wasn't good, Carrasco has been the crafty. He doesn't throw 100, but he's been the guy. He gets people out, keeps them off balance. He's given the Mets some really good starts, like that game against the Braves, game against just the one he just threw. You know, Carrasco's been he's been a godsend, man, you know. With DeGrom out, all these guys have had to step up. I had no faith in Carrasco, but he has completely stepped up. He has – if anybody had this expectation of Carrasco to the degree that he's – to the level he's pitching now, I'd like to meet that person, because I don't see how you could, coming off of where he was. Very, very pleasant surprise. My only concern with Carrasco is he's 35. And how will he look in October? I'm getting very confident, right? But how will he be holding up after a full season into the postseason? To me, that's a bit of a question mark. But yeah, I mean, Carrasco has been huge for the Mets, absolutely huge.
Sam, what's your confidence level?
Oh, man, it's really been beautiful to watch Cookie right now. He's just... He knows what you're watching, a veteran at his craft, especially this last game, right? I mean, he's also consistently giving you innings, and Buck is leaning on his veteran presence and the fact that he's saying that he feels uninhibited this year. So, you know, like Rich said, he's been a godsend. It's just been beautiful to watch.
For those who remember, he reminds me of Dennis Martinez. El Presidente, he was a real good pitcher, and so was Carrasco.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, Rich, his age, it was concerning to me, but he's proving his worth. Tyler McGill, he got shellacked his last time out. We talked about Tuan Walker and his effort today, stellar effort. He basically bulled his way through seven innings. Jacob DeGrom, he's throwing off a flat surface from 60 feet out, and, you know, things are looking up in that, insofar as he's concerned. But I think the most fun thing we can say about the pitchers right now is tomorrow Max Scherzer dons his black jersey at Citi Field. Rich, black jersey, Max Scherzer, how does that feel?
It's still surreal to me that he's a Met. After rooting against him, you know, for all these years, and you know, because he's a force out there, right? When he's on the other team, he really gets under your skin. But having him as a Met, having him don the black jersey tomorrow night, his leadership, you know, he got thrown out of the game. We all saw that to protect Dom a couple games ago, you know, last week. It's just, it's just great. I can't think of anything else to say. It's great to have him. It's great to know that he's on your team and all that he brings. He's not just a pitcher. He's clearly, you know, McGill is always next to him. The other pitchers are always next to him. He's helping guys. He's doing the things that a veteran leader and a future Hall of Famer will do. And just to watch that, you know, it's wonderful. And because again, he has so many benefits other than what he does on the mound. I just hope, Mike, that the Met fan fantasy that we had in December when Scherzer was signed, I guess it was technically the last day of November, that we can see DeGrom and Scherzer in the same rotation. I certainly hope DeGrom comes back. I am not 100% confident that he will. I want to be pleasantly surprised. But if we can get to that point, you know, I'm just getting comfortable with the fact that the Mets have Scherzer and that this is how great is this, having this guy on our team. I'm ready to be bowled over again by having both of them in the same rotation. I really hope it happens. That's where my head is. I'm finally getting used to Scherzer, but now I want to see them both, and I really hope I get to see that. We all get to see that.
Well, let me stay with you for a second. Scherzer, Carrasco, Bassett, McGill, Peterson, Walker. And you notice I didn't mention DeGrom. Let's leave DeGrom out of this. Are those pitchers, those six pitchers, are they sustainable? Yes or no?
I'm going to say no, not all of them. I do think something's going to go wrong. And I don't want to dominate the airways here, but let me give you a couple of thoughts. I think Scherzer's fine. I think we all know that. McGill, I worry about his innings. Walker, I worry about his innings. Carrasco, I worry about his durability. Bassett, I'm fine. I think Bassett's going to be just fine. So I've just said that 60% of the five I have a concern with, and I think they're valid concerns. You know, McGill and Walker just haven't thrown these kinds of innings. And maybe they can, but maybe they can't. Carrasco, again, his age is a real thing. So I have concerns with 60% of the rotation. That's another reason why I want DeGrom back so badly. That's what I'm hoping he comes back. Because you need to pad this rotation. Because there are a couple of – I still think there are question marks. If DeGrom doesn't come back, get aggressive to try to get a starting pitcher toward the trade deadline. Because tell me if you guys agree or disagree, but if you could have a concern, a legitimate concern about 60% of the rotation, one of those things is probably going to happen. You know, we have to hope it's only one, that only one of those three, the thing that I'm talking about, the bad thing happens. But I think it's fairly likely that at least one thing does happen. And they've got to insulate themselves. If that's DeGrom, you do it in-house, that's great. If not, they've got to be aggressive because I think when you have 60% of the rotation where you can pose legitimate question marks, you have to think about that.
Sam, the floor is yours.
I think that it is a no-brainer if DeGrom is not a question mark that you get another starting pitcher. And if he isn't a question mark, I still think, you know, it's not necessarily a question mark to go get one.
All righty. Just a couple of more little factoids. The staff whip is 1.09 heading into this game. It changed. And the batting average against was 0.212, both third in the National League, and those stats were heading into the game. Things are going well. The bullpen's been holding up. Is it sustainable? That remains to be determined. So, you know, let's see. Next, the Mets are coming home, and we play Seattle. Lo and behold. And I have to ask this question. Obviously, Jared Kelenic is an issue. The Robinson Cano trade, Edwin Diaz. But a name that rarely gets mentioned, if ever, is Justin Dunn. And he was a part of that trade that I really was against. I understand trading Kelenic, you have to give in order to get. So now, knowing what we know, you know, Cano's out of the picture. This boils down to Edwin Diaz for Justin Dunn and Jared Kelenic. Is this a thing? And by all indications, the Mets are winning this trade with a question mark? Rich, what say you?
In the moment, they are, actually. You know, Cano, by the way, signing with the Padres. How about that? Yeah, in the moment, the Mets seem ahead. Obviously, Kelenic has a long, long way to go, and could turn out to be great, done the same thing. So if you look at the snapshot in time, the Mets are probably ahead on the deal, even though they had to suck up a lot of money for Cano to get rid of him. It's probably tilted somewhat in the Mets' favor right now. But you know what, Mike? Let's not forget this. Diaz, free agent at the end of the year. Now, again, I don't think that it's time to lock him up yet, but at the same time, he has looked like the Diaz of 2019, and it's a decision the Mets are going to have to make. So let's just say, based on his demands or what have you, the Mets decide to part ways with Edwin Diaz. So you have nothing now. So the Mets could end up next year with nothing from that trade, and a young Kelenic and a young Dunn still with Seattle, who knows what they could do, and the Mets paying out their rear ends for Robbie Cano, paying Robbie Cano to play for the Padres. So in the moment, yeah, probably tilts a bit in the Mets' favor because of how well Diaz is pitching and the fact that Kelenic is struggling, and I honestly don't know what Dunn is doing. But I would say right now, even with the Cano money, it tilts toward the Mets. But imagine what this thing could look like if the Mets don't re-sign Diaz. Wow.
Just to bring everybody abreast on Justin Dunn, you know, you might consider this season his breakout season. Last year he made 10 starts. Right now he's up at 11 starts. 3.75 ERA over 50.1 innings pitched. You know, he's only given up 37 hits. However, his walks are through the roof. Otherwise, everything's good. Everything's positive. 8.8 strikeouts for 9 innings.
Is he in the big league?
Yeah, he's with Seattle.
Okay.
He's with Seattle, and he's, you know, he broke the starting roster with Kelenic, and they're both playing for Seattle. So Justin Dunn is pitching. His walks are through the roof. I'll admit that. Otherwise, he's doing okay. So take it away, Sam.
You know, it's going to be interesting to see if both get involved in this series. And is he starting? Is he in the starting rotation?
He's a starter for them. He's already made 11 starts.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you know.
Oh,
I know that Kelenic.
No. Strike everything I just said. I was looking at a baseball reference, and I'm going off his 21 season. I just assumed that was, you know, up to date with the season. So he might be in Seattle's minor league system. My mistake, I completely screwed that one up. I was looking at the 2021 stats.
Oh, well, you know, so it one way or another, thank you for that correction, but one way or another, it is, I think that, yeah, this is make or break. It's either, I mean, you know, I'm looking at it now, it's like, let's get our World Series championship with Edwin Diaz out of the way right now, just in case. but I have to think that going forward, obviously, depending on how this season goes, you would have to think this is on the watch of the Mets front office right now, the Edwin Diaz situation. I mean, you know, we're talking about Brandon Nimmo. We're talking about Edwin Diaz. I mean, there's a few. We're segueing away from certain chapters of Mets history, and we're watching it unfold in front of our eyes, you know, moments that you can say were an era. And, you know, that's part of what's palpably different about the feeling around last year's team, because Cohen with 2021 still kind of had this Wilpon-y aura around it, and Cohen did what we expected him to do. You know, some of us expected him to do was just not to take that anymore. And that's basically what happened this offseason, and we're seeing it unfold.
Well said. Well said. Gentlemen, I have nothing else. I'll throw it around the room if you guys have any outstanding issues or topics. Sam?
Yeah, I'll totally take over. And just, you mentioned the bullpen real quick, whether it was sustainable. Let's just, you know, give props to some names that we thought had flashes of brilliance in the past and we thought could be a humongous member of these teams, and that's Chasen Shreve and Drew Smith. I wanted to give props to them. I mean, they're kind of the unsung heroes of this bullpen right now that kind of held the glue together. Because even Seth Lugo, who had some rocky starts, is coming around. I don't know exactly. Everybody seems to be coming around when it comes to that bullpen, and I don't know whether there's a clear-cut weakest link right now, because everybody seems to be holding up their end of the bargain. And, you know, with, like, Sean Reed Foley, it kind of worked itself out. Trevor Williams is, you know, the long man that doesn't really get that much work one way or another. The bullpen. Let's touch on that real quick.
Well done by you, Rich.
Props to the bullpen. You know, Diaz has basically been an elite closer, which a lot of people said he wasn't. I don't blame any Mets fans saying he wasn't, because he hadn't been. But he pretty much is right now, and so you have that at the back end. Shreve has been fantastic. You know, he's one of those crossover lefties because of his changeup. He can get righties out as well. So Shreve has been very good. Obviously, Trevor May is down. Trevor Williams, whom I like, actually pitched very well last night, saving some more bullpen arms. He hasn't been great, but I think he's a piece that you want to have around because he can spot start. He can give you length. Ottavino's generally been good. He's had a couple of blips, but you know, relievers will have blips. So Ottavino's been good. Seth has been better.
Yeah.
You know, Seth.
I'd say Ottavino's the weakest link right now. I forgot about Ottavino.
Well, he can be good. He's had some very good outings, but he's been up and down. But that's kind of Ottavino. He's getting up there in years. Seth, I had concerns about, but he's been good lately. So generally speaking, the bullpen's been good. And again, I think it is sustainable. I think it's a deep bullpen that I believe is sustainable.
And
Joely Rodriguez
with the I've been pleased with the acquisition of Joely Rodriguez as well. So. Well done by you guys. Sam, Rich, you have any outstanding issues?
Just one. I wrote a piece for Mesmerize, not here for a self-shameless plug, but I think it's interesting to talk about real quick, on how Steve Cohen has really ramped up the analytics department, the IT department of the Mets. What he's doing is he's bringing in some talent from his brokerage firm, his hedge fund. And these folks, he's not paying them with hedge fund money. He's paying them with his own money. They're basically moonlighting as Mets employees. But these are like the IT people, the tech people, a couple of the HR people. They're actually doing two jobs. It was very clear they're being paid separately. They're being paid twice, but separately. But I think the reason I think that's important is Steve Cohen isn't just out there buying Max Scherzer and Francisco Lindor. He has a commitment to make this organization top-notch in every way, front office, on the field, everything. And he's putting his money where his mouth is in all facets of the game. So I just think as Mets fans, we have to pull back for a minute and be thankful that we have this guy, because this guy is in it for the long term. He's in it to make the Mets a sustainable powerhouse like the Dodgers, like the Yankees. And again, it's not just about buying the shiny new toy. He's building this organization into a powerhouse. And I think it's really important to note that.
Sam.
I think he's muted now.
No. It's going to be the continuous theme. I mean, I think that there were some clear cuts. You know, black and white analysis that Steve Cohen took, and what seems to be like the line of demarcation seems to be the whole Steven Matz thing. At least, like, that's the Abner double day for Mets social media, you know, when Cohen got mad type thing. That's their line of demarcation. And there seems to have been some black and white analysis that Steve did that provided just a bit more seriousness to the entire situation. You know, you guys were talking about 2021 earlier and thinking about, you know, everything that we thought was, you know, fun-loving at the time. The Mets were in first place, but kind of was just, you know, a little fratty, if you will, and didn't necessarily was just as sustainable as 2012 was. It's just 2012, we weren't in first place for much of the season. So, you know, this we just it was literally the worst that anybody has ever done who is in first place as long as we are, and as long as we were. And Steve took a good look at some things, and it started with the general manager, then it went to the manager, and then it went to the signing of Max Scherzer and some other ones that, you know, we've discussed over the course of this podcast. Marte, Escobar still needs to come around a little bit, but Canna is kind of the sleeper hit right now when it comes to the signings this offseason. And the, you know, like, you know, we a lot of us may have been part on the, like, Conforto needs to get, you know, more credit for how good of a major leaguer he's been. But it was just one of those things, and it seems that nobody's going to have a chance to sign him until next season now. It was one of those things where the Mets needed to make some clear-cut decisions that altered the course that they had been on. And whether it be Buck Showalter, Billy Epler, Max Scherzer, or not re-signing Michael Conforto, even though they were planning on having him on the team had he chosen to do so, it's just paid off so far.
It starts at the top. Gentlemen, I have nothing else, if you don't mind. We'll move into shameless plugs and our final word. Going once, going twice, we will move on. So, Sam, I will start with you. Give us some shameless plugs and your final word.
Well, I guess considering I'm walking through the streets of the middle of Brooklyn right now, I will first start with Bedford and Sullivan, the story of Brooklyn and its Dodgers. Always trying to find the sweet spot with that one, a hypothetical graphic novel, TV series / radio drama, whatever I can come up with from the get-go just to get some material going since it's been absolutely so long. But I also have a podcast. I've interviewed some ball players, including Carl Erskine. I've interviewed the late Larry King on there. And Peter McGowan, the late Peter McGowan, throw a shout out to him, who grew up a Giants fan in Manhattan, but owned the San Francisco Giants and actually, ironically, was a big force in keeping them in San Francisco. How about that? So, got a lot of good episodes over there and should have one brewing shortly. Final word too, Mike?
Yeah, go for it.
Well, I will say my final word is momentum. Just keep the momentum pushing forward. Like I said, everybody looks in you know, go time mode every single day with Buck. There's just an adult mentality to the entire operations, and like Rich just said, this is organizational now. We're seeing it change right before our eyes after just seeing such ugly Wilpon status quo for so long.
I couldn't agree more. It starts at the top. Rich, some shameless plugs, please, and your final word.
All right, Mike. I am a CT Mets fan on Twitter, and I write for Metsmerized Online. I pretty much have migrated away from the history stuff. We have someone else doing that, a name we know, Brian Wright. So I do like the business of baseball stuff that I completely love. So you know, you could find that stuff on Metsmerized Online. And my final word is sustain. You know, I know the Mets cannot sustain winning every series or not losing a series. They have tied one. Not losing a series for the rest of the year, that's just not possible. But sustain this good level of play. Sustain doing the little things. Sustain getting good pitching. Just please, Mets, don't do this to us again. I know this is a better team and a different team. Don't do what you did, as Mike said, last August and you know, fall into oblivion. Just please sustain this good, healthy, entertaining baseball.
Well said, Rich. Well said. Shameless plug, Brooklyn Charlie Blogger this year, this season. I'm replaying the 1890 Brooklyn Bridegroom season. It was their first in the National League. And they're up to a nice roaring start. It's a lot of fun delving into history. And I'm also, you know, keeping up with the Rangers playoffs and whatever else was going on and tickling my fancy. And of course, I cover the Brooklyn Cyclones and whatever else is going on in town. Final word, I'm having fun. You know, I like to play contrarian because I like to hear the truth from my partners. And I'm in lockstep with them, but I'm having fun. I'm not going to delve too deeply and start turning over all the cushions and tossing pillows looking for that rat in the grass. I'm having fun. So keep it up, guys. Let's go, Mets. And Sam, on behalf of Sam and Rich, I'll close this out by saying those three magical words in Metsville. Let's go, Mets. Good night, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Metsian Podcast. Good night, and we'll speak again next week. So long, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
Let's go, Mets.
Let's go, Mets.